Okay, all right, all right. I'm sitting in the bus. There's something underneath. Hey, Ralph. Hey, there's something down there that has to be turned up. It's not coming through well. No, it's down by your right hand down there, whatever it is that he turns up. I don't know what it is. It's not coming through here. There's something that isn't... He throws a thing down there, and it works then. I don't know what it is that he throws. There it is. What is it? Fine. Now it's off again. Now to switch it back. There, now. Let's keep it right there, see? Because we have some interesting... it's the way it is. I sensed it in the air today. I don't think there are many of you out there with any kind of juice in the glands there who didn't sense it. Spring was in the air, see? And whenever spring gets in the air, some strange things begin to happen to man's incisor teeth. Those canines, you know, it brings out all kinds of interesting things. It really does. And so I'm walking along there, and I can sense it in the air. The spring is up there. And it's all around me. See, now, wait, I'm walking along. Now, you got the scene, see? And I got on my spring-type raincoat, and there's a gentle rain falling on me. And I'm smelling that just that slight edge. You can tell it. It's just there. That slight edge of spring is there. And I'm beginning to feel that great flow of the primal juices through the vast network of primal juice canals that carry it to every part of the body. Back and forth it goes. Great smashing waves up against the eternal rocks of reality, smashing and crashing against the reefs of life. Boom! Well, I'm walking along there, see, and I'm making the scene. I'm looking up there at the sky, and I'm looking at that rain coming down. I'm looking at all them buildings leaning over, and I'm seeing all those people with the clean, fresh, scrubbed look of those who also feel flowing through their great canals that carry the primal juices back and forth. The flush, the rush, the roar, the tumult of spring. Okay, see, so I'm waiting for the bus. I'm standing there with the sound of spring just roaring through my old earballs and everything beginning to pick up there. And 5 minutes later, I'm on the bus. Well, I'm sitting in the bus. And we are moving along through just a slight, gentle rain. It's the kind of rain, you know, that makes you believe, honestly, that there will be spring flowers. What was that old canard that they used to speak so lovingly back there in that great inverted bowl of darkness and trepidation in the Midwest? What was that thing? What is it? Something, some kind of flowers bring something, or showers bring something, somethings? Well, anyway, the old showers were just gently trickling down the edges of the bus there, you know, along the windows, and I could see the patterns being formed and everything. And the other one first, I'll give you the cue there. And not yet, Ralph. No, we've got to do these things properly. And I'm sitting there on my old thing, just paying attention to nothing except those old juices are flowing through the great canals that carry all the primal juices back and forth. And, you know, it causes the contact lens of existence to cloud over with emotion. Well, I'm sitting there when the door opens and on comes this little old lady. I mean, she was the perfect little old lady. You know the kind of little old lady that Faye Bainter always plays but doesn't quite play it, doesn't quite make it. Because she's an actress. You know, there's that little rapacious look in the eye that means she's going to make it, and 10 minutes later she's going to be on the phone giving her agent what for. So that kind of, the mother as played in the films is not quite the way mother is. Well, this was the true one. Now give me a little rustle of spring there. We want to evoke all the images of motherhood here. This little old lady came on, and she's wearing one of these little pot-like hats, you know? You know the kind that has little flowers all over the top of it, you know, and a little feather sticking up here and there? Little wisps of gray hair held with little steel hairpins and little rimless glasses? You know the little kind of lady, you can hear little girdles creaking as she comes down? And she sits with her little fur trim coat right next to guess you know whom. Two human beings, two Japs, of tiny human flotsam caught in the great tidal wave of spring. Da 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 da. So, we're sitting there, and, you know, I'm looking out of the window, and she's looking across the aisle out of the window, and you could feel those gentle puffs of spring-like breeze coming up through that aisle there. It was wonderful, see? Well, I began to be conscious of a slight nudging of the right elbow on Granny in my floating rib. Well, Granny is making contact there, you see, and, you know, I don't know what to say. Well, what do you say to Granny, you know? But there she is. I can see that Granny's little glasses were glimmering in my direction from time to time. And I figured, well, you know, you're never too old to really make the scene. It's all in the mind. It's literally all in the mind, and it's spring and all that sort of stuff, you know. And I was feeling like a human tasty yeast bar anyway. And, you know, it was just kind of like, well, you know, let Grannies be Grannies was my feeling there at that point. Well, Granny starts nudging me in the old short rib through my raincoat. And I figured, you know, Granny, in any minute now, you know, no telling which way it was going to go, which way it was going to jump. And I'm looking out of the window. You never can tell with people. You know, they can go any direction. So I'm looking out of the window there, and the rain is trickling down, making those patterns, and there's a kind of a gentle fit. A little more spring music there, Ralph, just a little more to evoke the image of spring. Now at this point, you can feel Granny's elbow in my short rib. See, Granny is making little nudging moments there, you see? Granny is making contact. And I can hear the rustle of the breeze through Granny's little papier-mâché flowers that don their little spring-like fragrances on top of that little inverted pot of a hat that Granny was wearing over those little old tufted gray locks that covered those little shell-like ears. Boom! Oh, who can resist this? Come on, sing all together. Yes, this little black strap molasses drinker, this little wheat germ eater sitting next to me, this little believer in brewer's yeast, this little Carlton Fredericks listener was obviously making some sort of little motions. And then I receded slightly in my seat, and I thought of all the wonderful things that mankind had done in the past, owed all, of course, to grannies of one kind or another. The great Roman legions marching to bring Western civilization throughout the Mediterranean countries. Backed by a legion of grannies. The caves of ancient France. Yes, behind every saber-toothed tiger killer, there lurked a fur-covered granny. Great Inquisitions of Spain. Behind every burning cross, there lay somewhere, yes, the mail-coated conscience of a granny. All right, you got the scene. Okay, see, I'm sitting there next to Granny. Obviously connected. Don't put that away. We're going to need that. Obviously. Oh, no. Don't put it away. Obviously connected philosophically, biologically, physically, every other way to all the grannies that ever existed. Speaking of grannies, by the way, this is WOR, AM and FM, New York. And, hi, George. We'll be here until they pull the switch. But nevertheless, there I am. You got the scene. See, I'm sitting there on my imitation leather bus seat, and next to me is Granny. You got her there? Well, we went about 9 blocks, or 12 maybe, something like that, in the gentle falling spring rains here in the eastern seaboard region of this, the North American continent, in this year of our Lord, 1963, part of the great swinging 20th century. Well, Granny began to get a little pushy. It's the only way I can put it, actually. She was really digging. So Granny's pushing away there, and finally the time came when I could see that Granny was not only digging, but Granny was getting ready to move because she was making moving movements with her shopping bag. Obviously, Granny was signaling to me, "This is your last chance, Dad." It's now or never. In the next 15 minutes, I will disappear forever into the Great Maw of Abraham and Strauss. And you will never see me again. Yes, I will be swallowed up by the intestinal tract of Bloomingdale's. The great internal cavity of Macy's shall engulf me forever. Okay, so Granny's sitting there next to me, and without so much as a how do you do, without so much as a whoopee, Granny turns to me finally, and I can see she's just about getting up. She opens her granny bag, which is a great big tapestry-coated granny bag that has scenes of old Paris inscribed thereon, with a leatherette handle there with a big gold clasp on it. She opens up her granny bag, and a great whiff of... Ralph! No. A great whiff of granny... No, the other side. A great whiff of granny scent surrounds us. You know, that comes out of granny bags. That great, great, overwhelming odor of Helena Rubinstein violets. Several men in the immediate vicinity began to get a little nervous. When surrounded by granny scent, one is already at the ready. Okay, out. Well, all right, so there I am, see. Granny gives me this great big whiff of granny scent, softening me up for the final kill. Little did I realize what form the final kill would take. Granny then, in the best Shraftian voice. She spoke pure Shraftian, by the way. She was obviously not a Johnny-come-lately in the Shraft department. Granny was obviously a Shraft resident, or not only a resident, but a Shraft native by birth, not by confirmation or by conversion. Many Shraft ladies are that by conversion. This was one from birth. And she says, "Young man." I say, "Yes, Granny." "Young man, while you are continuing your bus ride, I would like to have you, if you will, read this." And with that, Granny, with the creak of Granny girdle stays, with the little snap and the pop that Grannies walk with all those little straps all over them, trailing an unmistakable trail, a wake of Granny scent, Granny whistles out, pops right out the back door of the bus, just like that. And there, clutched in my hot hand, was a granny message. I looked down at the granny message, thinking perhaps that it was a belated Valentine. But instead, what did I read? "Warning! Warning! Your home, your family, your security, your life is in immediate danger. If you are a businessman, a doctor, a lawyer, a teacher, a politician, a minister, a movie star, or if you simply believe in God..." "You are on the communist list for removal and destruction." I looked up from the granny message, and there I could see her just rounding the corner, her little shopping bag with the Bloomingdale sign on the side, bobbing cheerily in the spring air. I read on. "The communists are at war against the world with secret deadly formulas, diverse tasteless poisons, which simulate symptoms of various fatal diseases, heart attacks, cancer, hepatitis, paralysis, cerebral hemorrhage, etc. This battle includes kin against kin, spouse against spouse, thus the communist protracted conspiracy for world conquest. Communist Edward and Wally Windsor were chosen to be the rulers. Oh, Granny! The communist deadly formula was put into practice after the Russian Revolution in 1917, but soon realized their process lacked speed. So they masterminded, with the help of communist Adolf Eichmann and Eva Braun, to use Tool Adolf Hitler as their dupe to experiment world's reaction and the acceptance of wholesale massacre. Hitler, appearing as the villain in the eyes of the world, advanced the communist goal. Accomplishing the diabolical scheme, terrorization and mass liquidation spread throughout the sphere. Communists Eichmann, Braun, and Dr. Robert A. Soblin are alive and hibernating. Eichmann and Soblin's trials and newspaper deaths were but another tricky communist world deception. Granny! Bring back your violets, Granny! Upon appointing German communists Adolf Eichmann and Eva Braun to Germany, simultaneously communist agents throughout the free world were assigned for world conquest operations. In England, they appointed communist Sir Joseph Simpson, commissioner of Scotland Yard. In America, communist J. Edgar Hoover, Cardinal Spellman, and Justice Earl Warren were placed in complete charge of elimination and indoctrination to debilitate America's interior. Communist J. Edgar Hoover for civilians, Cardinal Spellman for military and religious areas, Cardinal Spellman is the director of USO clubs, Justice Warren for judicial departments. If America's communists are so able to deceive America, including Francis G. Powers, what are our chances for survival? The communist success in their secret operations are due to complete infiltration of the press, television, and radio by omitting publicity on these liquidations, enabling the communists to ambush their victims with these sinister, tasteless poisons without forewarning the victims who are to follow. These tasteless poisons can easily be counteracted if the public was to be informed and educated. While the communists are sabotaging, terrorizing, and insidiously liquidating loyal Americans, including Mr. and Mrs. Joseph Patrick Kennedy, American communists are diverting Washington with Cuba, Germany, disarmament proposals, atomic tests, filibusters. The communists, are, of course, are scheduled to seize completely America! Thus, the communist invasion of Cuba and the transporting of missiles, armaments, technicians, and ships. The communists are not about to destroy the Western Hemisphere with missiles, but to use missiles as a psychological threat of destruction to support the invasion of America. Khrushchev's compliance to disarm Cuba is but another deception of temporary world appeasement. Yes, Edward and Wally Windsor are chosen to be the world rulers. Deadly poisons are killing people all over the world due to hepatitis. But a few loyal Americans out of millions, the communist deadly formulas have insidiously liquidated. President and Mrs. Franklin D. Roosevelt, Fiorella LaGuardia, Senator Robert Carr, Clark Gable, Gary Cooper, Jeff Chandler, Dick Powell, yes, in order to halt these satanic communist forces, they must be exposed. I urge you not to put this obligation off until tomorrow, as tomorrow you may be one of their victims, as was Jeff Chandler. Wake up, America! Wake up! Well, I'll tell you, I was in a sweat. When I realized here all along, I had been misjudging everything all the way it was, you know. Now that I think back on it, I'll bet my Uncle Fred was a victim. Now, they told us, you know how they are, how those insidious doctors are, they told us that it was pneumonia. But actually, oh, I know now. And that time my cousin Warren got run over by the Mack truck and died terribly under the wheels of those tremendous onrushing forces of world annihilation. It was more than just a coincidence. We have here some commercials, all part of the great plot. Let's see. Here's great news for newspaper readers. Walter Winchell, are you aware that in the paper book gallery, this is not a commercial, this is, by the way, also true in all other bookstores in America, that one of the real problems is book stealing. And would you believe it or not, I guess you would, come to think of it, do you know that the number one type of book that is stolen, that the greatest amount of thefts occur in the philosophy department? Yes, and you realize, of course, that philosophy is concerned only with one thing. It's wrestling with the devil. It's wrestling with good and evil, you know. And obviously, a lot of cats arrive there in front of the philosophy department, and they begin to have the big wrestling match. And it's obvious who wins. Hold that tiger! All together, gang! All right, kill him, the whole crowd. Yes, indeed. Just thought you ought to be interested in what's going on out there among the granny world. You know, speaking of it's too bad we're not getting the news, you know, the way we should get the news, because there are things happening all around us, little significant things. For example, I would like to bring to your attention a little significant thing that comes from one of the New Jersey newspapers, and as a matter of fact, is from Hillside, New Jersey. I read it to you in its entirety. Do you have suitable portentous music in there, Ralph, please, for portentous? Yes, the great comedy of mankind, the great parade, the march is on. You will find there in the forefront Mickey Mouse, arm in arm, marching forever, forever with Goethe and Schiller. And there you'll see, standing directly behind Schiller, you'll see other great philosophers of the Mutton Jeff variety. Hillside, New Jersey, July 18th, United Press International. The Township Committee received the 17-signature petition last night asking that John Glenn Drive in Hillside, New Jersey, be changed back to its original name of Union Avenue. And so, indeed, fame passes sic transit gloria. Committeeman Max Schleifer pointed out that since receiving a 12-signature petition shortly after Glenn's epical flight, new street signs were erected, and the United States Post Office took official notice of the change. It became John Glenn Drive. The committee, he said, takes a dim view of this new petition. Three of the names on the second or new petition asking that the drive be changed back to its original name of Union Avenue, it was noted, also appeared on the first. I'll never forget which idiotic newspaper was it in New York City that recommended that after John Glenn went up for his great flight, that he be made president. Which one was it? Can you guess which one it was? One of the deeper-thinking papers of New York. Specializes in axe murders, you know, and aldermen caught in love nests, that kind of thing. Crash photos on page 3. Deep political thinking on the And here is, for all of you lonely folks out there, a little advertisement that I think you'll find in entertaining and interesting. And I certainly think that many of you will find it very useful in your daily life. Win sympathy. Get seat on the bus. Wear a realistic, phony cast. Yes, fracture your friends with this phony cast. They will think you have a broken arm. See them shed tears. Win sympathy. Get a seat on a crowded bus every time. This realistic imitation white plaster cast fits any adult's arm, smooth enough to write on. So you'll get your share of autographs, too. Great for getting loud belly laughs from friends, lodge members, etc. Be the first in your community to sport a phony cast. Give it as a gift. Comes complete with beautiful white sling, adjustable for all size people. Comes completely and attractively boxed. Yes. In your neighborhood, there will be an epidemic of phony broken arms. Have fun. It sure is a pain right down there where we're thinking of. You know, speaking of the idea of the phony cast, I'll never forget, you know. Of course, let us face it now. We might as well be honest. That almost every one of us, without exception, at one time or another, goes through a limping period. Or a period where, in some way, a limping period is when you, for some reason or other, decide that you are going to limp badly. Say you're 12 years old, or you're 14, and you develop a terrible limp. And this terrible limp, of course, people always look upon you with a certain amount of, well, it's not only sympathy, but in a way, it's like you're the wounded veteran who's been there at the front at Anzio, you know? And you sort of sit down, well, it's my bad leg, you know? I knew one guy. It's a funny thing. I knew one guy who carried this to a fine art in the Army. Should I tell you about that guy? Well, I knew a guy who could make any scene that he wanted in any town we were near by going into town, Carl, this guy in the Army I knew, by going into town, and he had the most majestic, beautifully delineated limp you've ever seen. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you what kind of a limp it was. It was very subtle. This was a limp in which most of the action was obviously the action of a fantastically brave man fighting against a limp. There wasn't a dry eye on the street when this T5 would walk down the street with this fantastic limp. And within 20 minutes, he is making the scene every possible way in every possible USO. And by the way, he very cleverly had it worked down to the point where he could even explain why he never wore his battle ribbons. A man with a limp, a man who's been there, does not have to advertise it. I don't wish to speak. Yeah, you know, speaking of guys making the scene in the Army, this is not a show about the Army, but I'll tell you, there are about 900 ways to make it, and you know, there are just about three guys, types of guys in the world. There's the type of guy who doesn't even know there's a scene to be made, and guess how many of us are in that department? Yeah, you know, and by the time we discover that there is a scene, it's too late. They have just closed the door. The guys who have discovered immediately that there is a scene and have made it, and by George, the first thing they do is lock up the desk. I'll tell you that, once they get inside, you know. Well, it's a funny thing about that. And you really meet the scene makers in the Army, and I'll never forget some of the great scenes that I saw, true scene makers. One of the best scene makers I ever saw was a scene maker who made his great move in the rifle pits in a camp out in the Midwest. Well, actually, it was in the Ozarks. You heard me talk about the rifle range one night? Did you hear that, Ralph? Well, we talked about the rifle range, and I'll have to briefly explain to you what the rifle range was. The rifle range was the rifle range, you know, and it was 300 yards long. There were 100 targets. And at the end of the range, there was a great parapet that, maybe it was 20 feet high, just sort of angled up. And that parapet, behind which cowered the guys who were pulling the targets. Now, the guys who were pulling the targets were the guys who an hour before, or maybe the day before, had been doing the shooting. Now they were back pulling targets. Now, let me describe to you what pulling targets means. You sweat in the sun or you freeze in the winter, and you have this big thing. It's on two tracks, two runners, and it's about, I don't know how big that target is, maybe 6 feet across, maybe something like that, and it has a handle on it. And you go, you push it up, And then you cower behind the concrete. It's just a big concrete wall. See, and you hang on back there, and you've got a big pot of paste. And the paste is big brush there, and they have big patches that are white. And you just one the hole. See, and you cower behind there. And then you hear, this is the rifle range. See, all the firing. One goes through your target, and you pull it down. Well, all you see, is this clown up there who's firing at your target is actually hitting the dirt about 40 feet ahead of the target, and nothing's going through your target but rocks. You see, a whole pile of rocks. So you take the rock that's closest to the bullseye, and you put a great big white thing on. You push it up, and then you hold it up there for a second while they're scoring it. See, target 37, 4, target 37, mark 4, and one-man ball ammunition, number 6, up target. Then you pull it down. Then you put the black patch over that. Then you push it up and you hide again. You see, you wait. And then you pull it down, there's no hole in your target, you see. You know the guy's shot. So you just take the plug and you stick it in the number 3. You stick it in, because the quicker you get this crummy thing over, the better off you are. You push it back up again. Mark number 3, target 37. Pull it down. Well, the rule behind this place was never drift out back of the targets. Stay right up against that crummy wall. For obvious reasons, because about every 30 seconds you'd hear one of the ricochets would go whistling off into the distance, you see, and you'd hear 4 miles away the bellowing of a wounded cow or a farmer somewhere out in Tippecanoe County, see. That's the way they go past, you see. So it was very exciting. Let me tell you, it was not at all like Errol Flynn in Burma, I'll tell you. And we're all hanging back there, and the thing was stay next to the wall. Well, I am looking down the long pit. There's 100 guys all lined up. When I see Lester, there was a guy named Lester Cantwell. Lester has a target, and he's wandering out around the back. And all of a sudden, Lester is winged. Lester got winged by a ricochet. Well, it was our first sight of actual shot by gun blood. 87,000 guys immediately turned white and lost their breakfast. Lester was winged right across the hand by a ricochet. Well, everybody's feeling sorry for Lester. The CO comes and reads him out. The ambulance comes and picks Lester up, shot by a 30 caliber ricochet. 4 days later, Lester is out of the army. 4 days later, Lester is back at Purdue, making the scene 84 different ways. Lester got everything but a Purple Heart, as far as I know. It was the first time I realized that there was a scene to be made, and there are a lot of ways to make it. All the while, I'm back there.